Good morning. Okay, yeah, thank you. This is Gene Lozano, the chair of the Committee on Access and Transportation, and I want to welcome you to the joint session of the Committee on Access and Transportation and the California Council of Citizens with Low Vision. For those of you who may be new, for at least 10 years, both groups have done a joint session on a variety of issues to do with access, transportation, the physical environment. This morning, we're being streamed, as the general sessions will be, and track three tomorrow, and then Sunday morning. This morning, we are going to hear a little bit about and get an update and explanation on a lot of things to do with Title 24, which is part of it's the California Building Code. And also, we are going to have presentations with regards to an update on the Caltrans ADA office on its work, as well as what Caltrans is doing with accessible pedestrian signals, how to make a request, if you got complaints, etc. And the last part of the program will be, we will have some advocates from different parts of the state who have had firsthand experience in getting APSs installed in their local communities. And so, this is be an opportunity for those of you who have been seeking the installation of accessible pedestrian signals to learn from some of the experiences we've all had and to get some ideas that how you can go back home and make requests with your local public works department or local Department of Transportation that's in this subject. I'm going to give Donna Sanchez, who is representing Bernice Candirian, and Bernice Candirian is the president of the California Council of Citizens with Low Vision. Donna would like to make some general comments, and then we will start our program. Thank you, and I will move the mic down.
I'll pass it over.
Good morning. This is Donna Sanchez. I'm treasurer of the CCCLV, and I am sending greetings from Bernice Candirian, our president, who was unable to attend. And we hope that you all enjoy and get a lot of good information from this presentation. And if anyone is interested in joining CCCLV, I'm here at the convention. Thank you very much. It's yours, Gene.
Okay. I have asked Mitch Pomerantz, past CCB president and Media Pass president of ACB, and many other titles, including very much having been involved in access, the physical access particularly, in the greater Los Angeles area, to introduce our first speaker this morning, who will be talking about Title 24. Hold your questions until afterwards, but you're going to hear a great deal of very valuable information about the building code as it pertains to access for persons with low vision or who are totally blind. So I'm going to give Mitch the mic.
Thank you, Gene. Sarun Sanashin is trained as an architect with graduate-level degrees in architecture and civil engineering and is a certified access specialist, or CASP, part of that program, and International Code Council, ICC, certifications. She has practiced in the European Union and the U.S., and is a member of the American Society of Mechanical Engineers, ASME, and serves as a voting member of the A18 ASME National Standards Committee, which promulgates regulations governing special access lifts in North America. She was the first disability compliance officer for the California Administrative Office of the Courts. Her firm provides services on a pro bono basis to many nonprofit entities, including the Ronald McDonald House. On a personal note, to kind of give credence to the expression, it's not what you know but whom you know, thanks to Gene Lozano, who had done some work with Sarun previously, and a conversation he had with my wife, Donna, I got connected to Sarun just about a year ago. And as a result, as part of the consulting business that Donna and I are now involved with, I am fortunate to be part of Sarun's consulting team. So I've had an opportunity to work with her personally over the last year. She's a great person to work with, and accessibility, both professionally and personally, is always uppermost in her mind, given how much of a non-techie I am. And she's worked very hard to work around my challenges. So without delay, let me introduce and bring on for the first presentation this morning, Sarun Sanashin of SZS Consultants.
Well, I am actually really excited to be here, probably much more than you are to have me, because I've always wanted to be able to talk to a group and really get their feel for what code does for them, doesn't do for them. And as you probably can guess, I love building code and I love details. I know most people don't, so I'm just strange that way. So I'm going to try my best not to put you all to sleep, because I'm really good at that too, because you can imagine when I'm talking about building code, most people just snooze after a few minutes. So I'm hoping that's not the case today, but I will keep an eye on all of you. And if you have any questions, certainly raise your hand or any comments. That would be great, because I definitely would like input on some of the things I'm going to talk about. Now, just to give you some background on what our firm does, we're not design architects or design engineers. We're a group of architects and engineers, but what we do is primarily litigation assistance and access compliance and ADA compliance. So most of our clients are involved in litigation or in a complaint resolution process, and so they come to us because they're not sure what to do. They understand building code fairly well because they're generally professionals themselves. Either they're city workers, so they work for a jurisdictional authority, or they work for a university or some private entities as well. And you'd be surprised at how little they really understand their obligations under the ADA. Even though it's been a law that's been in place for decades, there is still so much misunderstanding, and that's why they get into trouble and end up in a position where people have been complaining about their facilities, can't use their facilities, they don't know why, they're baffled by that, and then they end up not making changes and then end up in litigation, and then they come to us. So we do a number of things for them. We don't just look at their facilities, but what we really try to do is to help them change their process, change their culture, so that they don't end up in these situations over and over again. Some of that's based on building code, but a lot of it's based on a number of other things. So I was asked to talk about building code today, and so most of what I will talk about is based in building code, but I wanted to just mention, building code is not the only thing that we should really be concerned about. It's certainly an important code, but there's so many other codes that affect accessibility: civil code, government code, health and safety code, labor code, vehicle code, which has a lot of accessibility regulations, business and professions code, which actually tells architects and engineers, design professionals, what they should be doing, and then Title 24, which is the California Code of Regulations, that is the body of building code regulations that we are supposed to apply here in California. And I know that people here are here, experts from Caltrans, so I won't talk about the MUTCD or the PROAG, but there are also other codes that are not yet enforced that have accessibility guidelines, regulations that are held as a gold standard that through case law have become things that jurisdictional authorities, cities, counties, universities should be looking at. So we advise them that way. So just to be clear, a building standard means any rule or regulation or order or requirement that regulates or requires or forbids the method of use, properties, performances, or types of materials used in constructions, alterations, repairs. Sounds really technical, but a building standard is really a standard that has many different detailed pieces of information that help people to build buildings properly, not just in terms of access, but in terms of fire and life safety, in terms of structural safety. So it's a very complex code, and that's one thing I think a lot of people miss when it comes to architects and engineers is that they have a lot of responsibility. And because there are so many things they're responsible to know and to apply properly, a lot of times access is the last on their plate they think about. That's the difficulty. It's oftentimes the first thing they get sued for, but it's the last thing they think about in design. That's tough, and that's an industry issue, I think, that we as an industry need to deal with, but it's a tough one. It's a very tough one. I'll talk about that later in terms of why. So most of what I will talk about today also is about buildings, and a building is defined as a structure used for support or shelter, used for occupancy. The reason that I use the term building rather than facility is facility can be anything. It can be the sidewalk. It can be a parking lot. And a building, a structure, is different than that simply because of the occupancy idea of it. So I will leave the Caltrans experts to talk about pedestrian facilities because they are still a facility. Just like a building is a facility, but a building as a structure is still a bit different. So in California, we have a Building Standards Commission. They are the group that is required to develop and adopt and approve and make public and implement California building codes. It's not a closed process. In California, like a lot of things, it's a public process. So you actually have the opportunity to submit code changes that you feel would be beneficial for your use. And that's happened quite a bit, especially in access. There have been many, many changes to building code in California that were due to public comments and public submissions of request forms. And then they go through the public comment process and then go through the change process. And then they, every 3 years, go into code if they're deemed appropriate. So don't feel as though if you're not an architect or an engineer, you have no effect on code. It's not true. You actually have the opportunity as a member of the public to make recommendations for changes. In fact, I don't know if any of you know the name Richard Scaff, but he is a person that has made many, many recommendations for changes over the years, some of which have been adopted and then rescinded, some have been adopted and remain. So he's not the only person that can do that. Anyone can take that opportunity. And I would say if you really feel that you have a valid reason to want to make something codified in code and change it for the better of others, put forth the effort and do it. You know, do what you can to go to the meetings that are held statewide, the public meetings at the Building Standards Commission. There are forms online that are accessible, so you can fill out a request form to make a change and then go and make a public comment at a meeting describing why you want the change. So it's all possible. So just to let you know, California Building Code changes every 3 years, technically, not every single year. It's a lot of change, and it's a lot of technical work for people in the Building Standards Commission to do with all the changes. For example, I believe 3 or 4 years ago, they had 254 changes to make in 1 year. And they knew they could not do it, so they spread it out over 2.5 years because it was not administratively possible. So they're a busy group, and they have a lot of responsibility. So even though 3 years sounds like a long time between code changes, it's actually a very busy time for them, very, very busy. And they also have an 18-month intervening code adoption cycle. So every 18 months, so between, like at a half mark of that three-year time period, they also have a code cycle where they supplement any changes that have been made up to that point. So that then you're not waiting a whole 3 years for changes. You're waiting 18 months, basically. And every time they make a change, it's not like it's secret. They provide documentations online. They're called an express final terms document, which tells you exactly what was changed. And it doesn't just tell you the changes. It shows you in code exactly the section that the change came from and what is stricken out, what is changed, how it's changed, so that then you don't have to hunt through the code to figure out what they were talking about. And it's a really useful document to look at if you're really looking for technical code requirements. That's certainly a document to think about. So what I'd like to focus on today are physical elements that assist wayfinding for people with visual impairments or people that are non-sighted. They will be in structures, including play areas, which can be structures in the exterior space or in the interior space. So I think a lot of us, when we think about people with vision impairments, think about detectable warnings. That's the first thing that comes to mind. And they can be a lot of different things. Certainly, I think the number one thing people think about are truncated domes, those bumpy surfaces that people find when they're walking across a connection between the sidewalk and the roadway, whether it's a curb ramp or a blended transition. But they also mean wing walls or alcoves or guides, wheel guides or cane guides for people in the pedestrian facility or in walkways. And also signage, and that can be wall signage or door signage. So identification signage for permanent rooms and spaces. So I hope if I give you definitions from code, it won't be too boring, but I think I have to do some of that. So by definition, if a detectable warning is needed in a structure, in a building, it's because there's some kind of protruding object. And that protruding object is sticking out from the wall or from a pylon or some kind of post. If it's from the wall and protruding from the wall, it has to protrude more than 4 inches to be defined as an object that could actually cause injury. And it has to be protruding above 27 inches and below 80 inches. So roughly knee height to above my head, certainly, and above the head of most people, unless you're really, really tall. But you've all used a drinking fountain. I think everyone here has used a drinking fountain. And a drinking fountain is a fixture that commonly protrudes into a corridor, hallway, sometimes, but oftentimes near a restroom, so right near an entrance door. And they are supposed to be in alcoves, but one of the real controversies we have about that is we don't know how wide the alcove is supposed to be because code doesn't define that for us. So a lot of times as a designer, code seems to be very regulatory, and it seems to tell you everything that you have to, but it doesn't. It only tells you so much, and then you have to make judgment calls as to what to do past that. So I've seen an alcove in which a drinking fountain was placed because it would have protruded and people could have run into it when they were walking down a corridor, but the alcove was 6 feet wide instead of perhaps 3 feet wide. And code gives us no indication as to whether that's okay or not okay. I don't think it's so okay to be 6 feet wide, but I don't have the ability to prohibit it either. That's the difficulty sometimes. So just that, I want to just describe that scenario to give you the picture of what we deal with a lot of times as designers. It's not black and white. We have to make a lot of judgment calls, and we try to do the right thing. We don't always, like everyone, we make mistakes, but that's, I think, a lot of times what we try to develop over time is a better understanding to make sure that we make better decisions in the future. So one of the places that are really heavily used by everyone are stairways when it comes to traveling through a building. And there's something that's very, very useful for people with low vision, and for me too. I'm the kind of person that really benefits from visual cues because I'm a little bit clumsy. So when I'm going down a staircase or ascending, either way, it's really important for me to be able to tell the difference between each step. Technically in code, a step is the place where your foot goes is a tread. And on that tread, you're supposed to have a contrasting color that is different from the rest of the tread, so that if you're standing at the top of the stairway and you look down the stairway, you can tell the difference between the steps if you're outside every single step. If you're inside a building, the top and the bottom step of the whole stairway is supposed to have a contrasting color stripe. For those of you with low vision, have you experienced those? Have you seen those in stairways?
Yes.
Great. Okay. Well, they come in all shapes and sizes, which is not okay. I will tell you, code is very specific about those. But it seems like I've seen thousands of buildings over the last 20 plus years, and it seems like people think that they can be very creative about putting those stripes in, whereas code tells you exactly what they need to be. And code says that for interior stairs, they have to be on, like I was saying, the top approach, the bottom approach, and not every approach like exterior stairways, but they can't be anywhere on this tread. They have to be at least 2 inches wide. They have to be, well, between 2 inches and 4 inches wide, but a minimum of 2 inches wide. They have to be parallel to the edge of the stairway, and they have to extend the full width. A lot of times we find them right in the center of the stairway and nowhere else, or on the ends of the stairway and nowhere else, or we find that people think that more is always better. We have a client right now that has had their maintenance people go out and paint the riser and the tread solid white on their stairways. So the whole stairway is white. So really, I can't tell where I'm going. No one can tell where they're going. And these are all public places. Some of the stairways are brick surfaces, so they're uneven also, historic structures. So I think people mean well. They're well-intentioned when they do those things. They just don't understand that that's not useful for people with low vision at all. And in fact, it's really even more confusing. So one of the places that's important to think about is that color contrast on stairways. Well, it's not something that is so unimportant that it only is required on some stairways somewhere. It's actually required virtually everywhere. We're talking about pool stairways. So if you go to a swimming pool, if you swam in a pool, you've probably used a stairway to get in. It's required there, those stairs. We never see it in the field when we're looking at existing facilities, because I don't think people understand the code that clearly. It's a requirement, but it's not applied well. But also, when it comes to play structures, if you have kids or you have grandkids or you've been to a playground or a daycare center, and there is an elevated play structure, which means a play structure that's not just a ground level, but has stairway or it has a ramp. If it has a stairway, those stairs have to have that color contrast as well. And code also has another exception that also goes even further to state that even if a stairway is not being altered, which is typical, that the contrasting color should be provided. So one thing it's a number one priority for us when we're recommending to clients to make improvements, especially for people with vision impairments, to put in contrasting color in their stairways, because it's an inexpensive solution and it helps so many people. It helps me, it helps the general public, and it helps people with disabilities. And it's, since it's a low cost solution, it's oftentimes one that people are open to providing. So, going on, the next section I wanted to talk about is signage. And I will tell you, signage is very controversial. I've spoken with a lot of people over the years about signage because it seems to be the one place when it comes to access regulations that people, that design professionals, have the least understanding. Because code is very specific about signage, but we don't see compliant signage very often. And I'm not sure how many of you have experience in doing any design or construction, but signage packages, which means providing signage throughout a building, are in the neighborhood of several $100,000 to several $1 million for a large structure. So it's very costly to provide, and yet we find probably 85% of the time, 90% of the time, that the tactile information, the braille information on signage is not compliant. And it's not, I think, necessarily the fault of our clients, but they rely upon vendors that don't necessarily follow code. One of the reasons that happens is because until recently, until these new ADE standards were published and enforced in 2012, there were two kinds of Braille in the U.S. You probably know that better than me, because I think everyone here probably knows much more about Braille than I do, but there was an ADA standard for Braille and a California standard for Braille, especially in signage. And if a company used a nationwide vendor to provide their signage, that nationwide vendor most likely had fabricating machines that only fabricated ADA signage, ADA Braille for signage, not California compliant Braille. So they didn't know that, and oftentimes purchased these signage programs from these vendors thinking that they were doing the right thing, had no idea that it wasn't compliant in this state. Now, from the point of 2012 on, since this new code is in place, the ADA has actually adopted California standards for signage for contracted Braille. So now, nationwide, the standard is the same. So any new signage going in really should be fully compliant, whereas in the past, it was pretty uncommon. In fact, even when it comes to building officials, these are the people who approve plans to build buildings or to alter existing buildings. They very seldom understand the complex requirements for signage and don't even look at those packages. So I'm going to read a little bit of something to you. One of the things that is very unique about California Building Code is something I explained earlier, this process that allows people to make public comments and change the code, improve the code, make additions to the code. One of the things that was added through that process two code cycles ago, so almost 7 years, 8 years ago now, is a requirement for every city that approves building inspections and gives certificates of occupancy for their new buildings to be used. When a building is finished, it has to be approved, inspected, approved, and then given a certificate. But before they do that, they're now required by law to look at all of the signage and make sure that the accessible elements in the signage are 100% compliant. That has been a requirement for almost 8 years in California, but we work with jurisdictions across the state, and we don't know anyone who does it. So it's interesting that the requirement was inserted into code because it's a well-known fact that the signage that's being fabricated and installed everywhere across the state is virtually never compliant when it comes to Braille and tactile information. And so they updated the code, added this requirement, and yet the requirement's not being applied either. So if that just tells you how difficult signage is as a topic, it's a really tough thing, because our clients are paying for it, then they install it, it's not compliant, they're surprised or shocked that it's not compliant, and then they don't know what to do when they end up getting in trouble because of it. So it's not a simple situation. One of my biggest concerns is I'm not sure that many building inspectors understand the requirements enough to inspect the signage. And another thing that often happens is signage is something that is installed in a building long after the building is complete. In fact, it's oftentimes installed after all of the furniture is in and all the carpeting is in and the paint is done. And when people are already working in the building, that's when they put the signage up. And because of that fact, the inspection has already been finished for everything else in the building, and the inspectors are not going to come back. They're done. They signed off on the building. And so that makes this process even harder, because then they never even see the signage. And the plans for the signage from the signage vendor are not submitted with all of the other plans for the building that they already looked at and approved. It's totally separate. So then there's that big disconnect. And I think that's the biggest problem with signage, is that disconnect just means no one's looked at that vendor package. No one really knows whether it's compliant, and yet it's going to get installed. So, okay, are you all terribly bored now? Raise of hands. No? I know this is really technical, and it's not the easiest kind of information to take a whole hour of, and I'm sorry about that, but I'm going to try and do my best to keep you all awake. So when it comes to signage, for people with vision impairments, I think you understand signage very well because it's so valuable to you. Raised characters are letters that are raised above the surface of the sign. We see signs that are made in all kinds of creative ways with many different raised layers on them or pieces that are different. And I always wonder to myself what a signage manufacturer is thinking when they make a sign with five different pieces with different layers and levels that also has tactile information that someone's supposed to find on that sign and read with by touch. I'm not sure that the designers of the signs are thinking about Braille and about raised letters and how it's not that easy to read them, let alone figure out where they are when there are several different layers on a sign. So code prohibits that kind of thing, but designers don't necessarily consider that so much. And if their client doesn't tell them they can't make these inventive signs with many layers, then oftentimes they end up being installed. So our concern is to try and help our clients understand that the most useful signage is the simplest signage, especially when it comes to tactile information. And so when we talk to them about raised characters, what's required to be raised is important. For example, one of the litigation cases we worked on was with a radiology group, which is a group of medical professionals that do all kinds of tests on people. So they're not doctors. They're not doctors you go to when you're sick, but if you have to have a CAT scan or an MRI or something like that, your doctor sends you to them. And so you go to their office and you wait in their waiting room and then they take you in and do whatever test is required. But in their waiting room, they have a drinking fountain. And one of the things I saw at a drinking fountain was this enormous sign with raised letters and Braille below each sentence. And there were 7 or 8 sentences on this sign, right? Because the sentence or the sign was saying, if you are here for this procedure, and this procedure, you shall not be drinking any water now. You should go and sit down, basically. That's what the sign was telling people. And yet, for some reason, someone thought this was a great idea to Braille and to make in raised letters. And I thought, you know what? First of all, this thing's behind a drinking fountain on a wall. No one's ever going to find it that's looking for tactile information, right? And who's going to read a paragraph of Braille or raised information above that? Who's going to do that, right? I don't think anyone with a vision impairment ever set a hand on that sign ever, but it was a hilarious sign. I have a picture of it for training purposes to show clients and say, do not do this because this is not useful for anybody and it probably cost a lot of money as well. So that's the kind of thing people do. They try to do the right thing, they intend to do the right thing, but they just don't understand the usability of tactile signage. They don't understand how people use it. So code has actually changed quite a bit in that respect. I don't want to go too much into the really, really technical information about character height and stroke thickness and stroke height, because that will definitely put you all to sleep. But some very, very important things have come out of code recently with the ADA updates, and they have to do with the way in which signs with tactile information are installed. And the position of Braille is an important thing, too. You probably know this better than me, but I don't think a lot of signage vendors do. Braille can't go just anywhere. Can't go on the top of the sign or the middle of the sign. It has to go below all of the raised characters, and they should be on the bottom. Because a sign can be 3 inches high. It can be 30 inches high. It can be a large sign in some large buildings. And if the Braille is strewn everywhere in that sign, can a person really read it all? You know, it's not practical. So putting it at the bottom makes it simple because someone can read the bottom of the sign with their hand, know where the bottom edge is, and then know that just above that, within 3/8 of an inch to a half inch, that's code, is going to be the information they're looking for. So that's that concept. When you explain that kind of thing, a lot of times people start to think, oh, you know, maybe I need to rethink the way that I have signs designed in the first place and how much information goes on them. That goes back to the concept of simple signage, information that's essential on a sign rather than this sign I described behind this drinking fountain. So one of the things that is new in code that's very, very important is that there's been a big change as to where signage goes. It used to be 60 inches on center, period. Code didn't tell you where at a doorway or at a door it had to be placed, so we see signage sometimes on the latch side of a door and on the hinge side of the door. Well, when you're entering a door, you're going to go to the latch side and operate the door hardware and open the door. That's where the sign should be. who enters a door at the hinge side? Well, nobody does, right? So if you're putting the sign up on the hinge side, no one's ever going to find it that needs that tactile information. So code now is very, very specific. When you're entering a door, it's on the side, the latch side when you're entering. If you're exiting a door, it's on the latch side when you're exiting that side. But it's also not 60 inches on center, because think of a sign's 30 inches high or if a sign's 3 inches high. If 60 inches on center is your requirement, those signs are going to be all over the place. So think of how big a sign can be. That's the reason it was changed to no longer being 60 inches on center to being for the lowest point at which tactile information is provided is 48 inches, no lower than that, and no higher than 60. So that gives people a big range now. 40 to 60 is a nice, healthy range for people to fit that tactile information in, rather than thinking, okay, I don't care where the tactile information is, the whole sign has to be centered at 60 inches, and that's what everyone was doing in the past. So it's much simpler, first of all, for an installer to put the signage up correctly now, because in the past, a lot of our professional colleagues who do assessments for litigation would call out every single sign in a building because they were an eighth of an inch off of 60 inches on center. Think about that. So that kind of thing doesn't make anyone happy, and it's not really that useful in the long run. It's a code violation, but it's such a minor one that there's so many other things that are more useful for people to think about. So this is a very useful change in code because it gives everyone a logical, understandable way to apply signage where it's supposed to go so that people will find it that need it. And past that, there's another part of that code that was something like it was in California Building Code, but not this clear. This comes directly from the ADA standards, which I think is really great. And what it says is you can have a tactile sign, and you need to have it in these specific places. So if you're entering a door, it has to be on the latch side as you're entering. If you're exiting, the latch side as you're exiting. But you have to be able to touch the sign, like that sign at the drinking fountain I was talking about. That sign no one could get near to read by touch. So now that sign, that tactile sign, has to be within an 18-inch space adjacent to the door. And this is a big deal for architects because I will tell you, architects love glazing, which is windows or clear, transparent glass. They love putting that in next to a doorway, but they do not love putting signage on that. That's like a no-no, a visual no-no to them. But I can tell you as a trained architect, there's just something in your head that just doesn't like certain things and the way that certain things look, you know? But when you think about usability, you should be thinking about usability perhaps before aesthetic qualities like that. So what we see a lot in office buildings is a door, and then directly next to the door at latch side, which is the way you'd go into the door, a glazing panel, so like a glass panel, and no one puts the sign on there. They put it 30 inches, 40 inches away from there on the next wall space. Well, do you think that any of you are ever going to find that sign? No, you never will. And so that sign is useless. You may as well not install the sign. So a lot of what we do right now is in new construction, looking at buildings where people have, in plan, told the installer to put those signs on the wall, not on the glazing, because it doesn't look pretty, they think. But now that's a code violation. It has to be within 18 inches of that door. So I think that's probably one of the biggest improvements in building code when it comes to signage in longer than I can remember. So I'm really happy about that. And I would like to hope that people start actually applying it. So a lot of our clients are moving signage as we speak because they had just recently installed signage packages and didn't know about that change. So in the sake of time, I know we started about 15 minutes late, so I think I have about 30 minutes left, but a bit more to cover than that. So what I wanted to touch on were a few concerns. One of the things that I talked about with several people about was a concern that some signage was no longer required, and those signs are the geometric symbols at sanitary facilities. So we're talking restrooms, toilet rooms for men and women, or unisex toilet rooms, or locker rooms, those kinds of rooms that have showers and restrooms in them. So California is the only state in the country that has this requirement for a 12-inch circle or a 12-inch equilateral triangle to be installed on the door or doorway, if there's no door, entering into one of these facilities to tell people the gender of the facility. So rather, the pictogram issue is a big issue, and since I don't have time, I won't go into that, but it's very controversial. People don't, designers, graphic designers as a designer, do not like pictograms and don't want to put them up. So in California, at least we have another option with the circle and the triangle, and I know there's concern, and I've talked to several people that think that, or had the impression it was leaving the code, it was no longer a requirement, and that's not the case. Yeah, it's in code now, and I've talked to the Building Standards Commission. There's nothing in the next 6 years that has been proposed to remove it. So that's an important thing in California for people, not just people with vision impairments. People with cognitive impairments are oftentimes trained to understand that if they're male and they need a male restroom, that they look for the triangle, and if they're female, and they look for the circle. So it's a very valuable requirement. So in the time I have left, I want to talk a bit about detectable warnings, because I believe out of all of the controversial things in code, detectable warnings are probably top on that list. I think it's one of the reasons why the public rights-of-way accessibility guidelines have not been finalized for so long, because there have been so much pushback. We have a lot of clients, for example, that have a very close relationship with developers, and for example, or have architects that work for them that are very very influential, that convince them that they're not really useful anyway and they don't look very nice, so we should just not install them at all. And it's very common. In fact, I know a lot of architects who actually are considered access experts who believe that truncated domes do not serve a purpose for people with vision impairments. I don't, you know, I've asked them why they think that, if it's anecdotal evidence they're basing that on, or, you know, they have any research to base it on, and they don't necessarily respond to that, but they talk a lot about the fact that they think they're a failure, that they don't work, that they're not useful, and I think that's very unfortunate, because I think it's just the opposite. I think one of the problems with them is that they're used in places they're not required, and then they become confusing. So that's, I think, one of the biggest problems with them. But they are very useful for people with low vision and for people that are non-sighted that use white canes. I think you might not know how code talks about them, but the way that code talks about them is, in California at least, there is required to be a sound on cane acoustic quality difference. That's a mouthful, I know that, right? Sound on cane acoustic quality difference. And that means that if you come to a stop at a sidewalk, for example, and you think it's probably a crossing into the roadway, there should be truncated domes there, but those truncated domes, that detectable warning, should be distinctly different from the concrete next to it, so that if you tap your cane on it, there's a sound difference, an acoustic quality difference between it and the tapping on the concrete. Does that make sense? That's what code requires in California. But this is something a lot of people have never even heard of, to be honest. When we do plan review and we see that they don't say much of anything about detectable warnings in plan, and then we ask in our comments to provide the information and we give them the code reference for that sound on cane acoustic quality difference requirement, they say, what is that? And where did that come from? We've never heard of that before. That's what the comment is that we get almost 100% of the time from designers. And not just architects, civil engineers, people who are doing civil work. So they're designing sidewalks day in, day out. They have never even heard of it. So it just tells you there's a lot of misinformation out there, let's just say that. So a lot of the changes that I think are really great when it comes to detectable warning recently are the directional texture that is very useful for transit facilities, but even more so, you might know the history of truncated domes and how originally there were mostly radial patterns, but then people with incomplete spinal cord injuries that use wheelchairs complained quite a bit about the fact that it actually was uncomfortable or even painful for them to bump over those bumps when they crossed a curb ramp every single time they crossed the roadway, or in a hazardous vehicular area, perhaps in a parking lot, when they had to bump over them, or if they go to Walmart and there are 600 linear feet of them, right, where they're not required at all. But this is a controversy. You know, people with disabilities are not a cohesive group. There are lots of disabilities out there, and they all have different needs, right? So One of the things that I think was a great change in the code was that instead of just going from requiring a radial pattern to have truncated domes at all, then they went to an inline pattern, trying to provide sort of a trough area or a flat area within the truncated dome pad where people could align their wheelchair wheels and roll down it. Well, that didn't work so well, so what they did is they changed the spacing completely. So you can have a radial pattern or you can have an inline pattern now, but the spacing between those domes is quite wide, much, much wider than it was before. So now it's really easy for someone to align their chair and then roll through a truncated dome pad without hitting one bump. So then the difficulty that people have with complete spinal cord injuries is pretty much solved. The difficulty is that all the truncated domes that have already been installed don't comply to this new standard. So there's still going to be an issue for people who have that problem. So newly installed domes should apply or should comply to this new standard. And if they do, then they serve the greater population. Yes, question? I do. I know exactly. Do you want me to tell you? That's the kind of thing that bores most people to death, right? But yes, directly in code. In fact, it's very, very specific. Let me read it to you exactly. So dome size is regulated. Dome spacing is regulated. So the domes themselves have a base diameter of 0.9 inches. And I will tell you, 0.9 inches is not easy to measure because our system is not in 0.9 or, you know, in tenths, right? But even so, this is the measurement. So 0.9 of a dome or base diameter minimum to 0.92 inches. So there's a little bit of play there. And then the spacing, that's the number one most important thing in my view, is 2.3 inches to 2.4 inches. This is almost 60% wider than it was before. It's really wide.
And that's one of the things we did.
Gene? Can you hear Gene? He's commenting on this.
Yeah, I just wanted to let you know that that's something that one of the many things when we got detectable warnings put into the code that we got this changed to try to overcome some of the opposition. I've been asked to let Sarun finish her presentation, and then we'll give questions, and we'll ask that Sarun repeat the questions because we don't have somebody, unfortunately, to run around to the mic. So ask for your understanding. Go ahead. Okay, well, we'll hold off to the questions until Sarun finishes because she's going through a lot right now. And we're given more time for her to do so.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
It's a lot of information because there's one other thing I wanted to talk about, which is really complex, and that is the new requirements for ATMs and fare vending machines that are really pretty amazing in my view. Now, I will be honest with you, I am not an expert on these, and they are pretty new requirements. We use them in the field. So when we work with campuses and we're going through a campus measuring a pedestrian facility, we come across ATM machines commonly, and we take measurements at them. And they now have requirements for so many things that didn't have any notion in code before. So it's a really huge improvement. So let me explain just a bit about them. So I know most of you probably use ATM machines of some sort. Code describes them not as ATM machines anymore. CBC used to just talk about ATM machines, and when it comes to architects and engineers, they want to be 100% specific. So if it wasn't an ATM machine, they were not going to apply those requirements. Even if it had speech output and it was something similar to an ATM machine, they would not require anything to be accessible on it. So now code talks about speech output, a machine with speech output as something that has requirements. So in 11B7075, that's a technical section from code, speech or machines, fare vending machines, ATMs, shall be speech enabled. They have to be speech enabled now. So if you're sight impaired and you want to use a machine, you have to be able to because it provides speech, or because there is that enablement that was not there before. That's a huge, huge, huge step forward. Operating instructions and orientation, visible transaction prompts, user input verification, error messages, and all displayed information for full use She'll be accessible and independently usable by people with disabilities with vision impairments. Huge, huge requirements that I will tell you most banks, most credit unions that have ATMs are not aware of. So we were aware of these requirements coming in as in the final express terms several years ago before they came into the code. And we were working on a litigation case for a community college, and we gave them to their legal counsel and explained that the ATMs we had seen were not compliant. And he said, well, what does it mean, not compliant? So we gave him this code, and he said, well, I still don't know what this means. It's just a bit too complicated for me. So we've been working with them to try and explain to them what they need to tell their banks and credit unions that install ATMs on their campuses that they need to comply with. So not only does it have to have speech, but the speech has to be delivered through a mechanism that's readily available to all users, including but not limited to an industry standard connector or telephone handset. Very important, especially in a loud or noisy environment, so that you can carry your own headset, plug into the jack, and then listen to the input and use the keys that now have raised information on them as well. So the speech can be recorded, it can be digitized human or synthesized, which is great when it comes to readily available technology today. There are some exceptions. So for example, they'll allow audible tones instead of speech for visible output if it's not displayed for security purposes, for example, receipts, things like that, account information. There's an exception for advertisements. I don't know if many of you have experienced this, but a lot of gas stations in the last few years, when you're pumping your gas, you get to listen to advertisements too. It's so enjoyable, right? Those don't have to be made accessible. I'm not sure they're really that valuable, but you know, it's a matter of capitalism and something we can't do much about when it comes to advertising. Now, user control is a big deal with these machines as well, because the speech that these machines provide has to be capable of being repeated or interrupted. Why? Because you don't get it right the first time. How many times, when I'm standing at an ATM and it says something to me, I'm oftentimes thinking of something else and just don't catch it. So if you have to catch it the first time or forget it, you're in big trouble. So those machines have to allow you to either interrupt it and repeat it again, or stop it and start it over again. So that's a great requirement, because I think it's useful for everybody. Pass that receipts. Very, very important when you're talking about any kind of financial transaction, any kind of fare vending machine, when it comes to parking, when it comes to an ATM, many, many places where these are important. Wherever a receipt is provided, a speech output device has to be provided with an audible balance inquiry information capability, error messages, and all other information on the printed receipt necessary to complete or verify the transaction. So no longer is it just who knows what's on that little thing that was printed out that I have to get out of that little slot. It has to describe everything that's printed on that receipt. I think it's pretty amazing. And you know, today this is all possible with technology. Technology makes this possible for all of us, but it's an incredibly valuable thing that we have technology that can do this fairly simply that was not available 20 years ago. So input, this is yet another step in this whole process. So when you're at the machine, you have to put information into it to get the information out that you need, right? Whenever you go to an ATM, a fare vending machine, if you need a parking pass, many other instances, you have to input information. So input controls are also controlled very, very specifically. There has to be at least one tactilely discernible input control provided for each function. So where they're provided, the key surface that you press, where key surfaces not on active areas of display screens, where they're not on the active areas, they have to be raised. So it's not the situation where people have existing ATM machines and they can put stickers on top of their key tab, which you know they would do, okay, if they could, right? They can't just put a little sticker on every one of those keys and say, there we go, we have those new symbols. They have to be raised. Why? Because they have to be tactile, right? It makes sense to all of us, but you know what? If you don't understand the basis for tactile information, you'd probably want to put stickers on these things and think that you're done with it. So the order in which the numeric keys are required on a pad are ascending or descending, pretty similar to what is required in elevators as well. The function keys, very important. There is also a requirement for contrast for people with low vision. So it's one thing to have fully tactile information and audible information for people with that are non-sighted, but contrast is important for people with low vision. So the keys cannot be the same color as the background face of the machine either. They have to be discernibly different. So there is a lot of technical information on this. I knew I would not get out through all this, to be honest. Just this section with input user control is so complex. But there are a couple things I want to point out so as not to go too much further over time. But the tactile symbols are very specific. For example, the function key surfaces have these kinds of tactile symbols, specific tactile symbols. Enter or proceed key has a raised circle. Clear or correct key has a raised left arrow. The cancel key has a raised letter X. An add value key has a raised plus sign. A decrease value key has a raised minus sign. So when you need to use an ATM for financial purposes, it makes it quite clear as to how what keys you use and why. So the last thing I want to talk about when it comes to these machines is the display screen. And this would be something that affects people with low vision or short people. I do have friends that are short. In fact, a lot of my gene pool is below 4'11", which is qualified under the ADA as someone with a disability in terms of reach, range, and height, right? So those monitors on a lot of old ATMs are so high or are angled inappropriately so that people can't even read them when they're short. So they can reach the keypad, but they can't really see what's going on the display. So there are also requirements now, not just for displays in general, but for vertically mounted displays, angle mounted displays, and horizontal mounted displays, because all three are manufactured on these machines. So, okay, one last thing. Of course, as you expected, Braille instructions are required on these machines. This includes point of sale devices. So the technology, oh, and they also have one question, or one section, I want to read this to you because I thought it was really interesting. It's an other technology section. They wanted to sort of cover the fact that things have changed so quickly in tech. So this section, 707.9.1.2, reads, other technology such as radio frequency identification device, fingerprint biometrics, or some other mechanism that enables a visually impaired person to access the video touch screen device or his or her personal identifier, and to process his or her transaction in a manner that provides the opportunity for the same degree of privacy input and output available to all the individuals. Where a video screen overlay is provided, it should be equipped with a tactilely discernible numerical keypad complying with this section. So it's not just the keypad. If it's really high tech and they don't even have a keypad, they just have a screen, a monitor, a display, it has to have these same requirements. So then they're going to be putting tactile raised circles and arrows and all these other things on their display monitor. So that makes them think twice, I think, about thinking about consolidating all technology into one place, which makes it much more difficult for people with disabilities to oftentimes discern between the two. So, okay, that's a lot of technical information. I think I probably definitely used up all of my time. So if you have any questions now, I'm certainly open. Okay, we're going to bring the mic to each of you. There are five questions now. So hold on just a moment, and we'll get to each of you. We're going to start at the back. That might be the easiest. So you're going to have patience if you're in the front. Sorry about that.
Hello, my name is Lorraine Devaney. I'm alternate delegate, San Francisco chapter. Anyway, my question was about getting Caltrans input on accessible signal. They had a problem.
Yet.
Can
we're
anybody hear me? Okay.
No, we're not at Caltrans yet.
Oh, we're not there yet.
Yeah, it's coming. I did not say anything about that because I knew people from Caltrans were here. There are two other sections in the presentation today that we'll talk about.
Hold
those questions. They're still coming. Hold on. Still in the back.
Yes. My name is Michael Alvarez. I wanted to just talk a little bit about, you were talking about the signage in buildings, and then just a lone little story. I was successful, after over a year of battle, to get I'm a member of 24-Hour Fitness to install ADA-accessible restroom signs in the club that I go to. And one of the things that really held it up was they were, manager was saying, I have to talk to other clubs to see how it will damage the integrity of the property. That was his words.
That's right.
So I just want to tell you, if you want to get these things installed, it can be done, but you might have to deal with the most undesirable arguments that you could ever imagine.
You will. I have to agree. For example, one of the big deals with detectable warnings is architects and engineers think they are unsightly. They're unattractive. They're even ugly. So because of that, we're not installing them in yellow. We're going to install them in gray. But the concrete's gray, and they're required to contrast against the concrete. So that's a problem, because gray on gray is not something with low vision, or something that someone with low vision would notice. So what they've allowed, too, is to put an inch of black striping around them when they don't contrast enough. That's an allowable alternate exception in code. I've never seen it in the real world. No one's done it yet, even though it's necessary in a lot of places, because that gray on gray is pretty popular. But people will install truncated domes in a zillion colors. We have campuses, for example, that use their campus colors and install truncated domes in burgundy because that's one of their campus colors, for example, or green because it's one of their campus colors. That's pretty popular on university campuses. Okay, sorry, let's go to another question.
My name is Christy Crespin. I work at Patton State Hospital Forensic Facility. And I'm wondering, what is the status of a state hospital? Is it a public entity? Their signage is nil. They put metal strips on the edges of the concrete steps, which is wonderful for my guide dog when it's summertime, and other various things. But I'm just wondering, are they considered to have to be a part of the ADA signage and building code?
The answer would be yes, absolutely. The ADA has five titles, and one of them covers public entities. So any public entity, which is a state or local agency, is a title to an ADA Title II agency, and they are absolutely required to comply. And one thing I want to mention about the contrasting stripe, the skid guard on the tread, the stairway tread you talked about, that is probably really hot for your dog's paws. Mm-hmm. Those are things that are required to be installed for slip resistance on stairways. So they're installed everywhere because that's a risk management issue, and everyone is big on risk management. But a lot of people think that qualifies as a contrasting color. It does not. Absolutely does not. In fact, that's why code says that contrasting color is an inch away from the nosing, whereas that slip-resistant strip has to be at the nosing. So they are not the same thing. And it's probably an older facility that hasn't been upgraded, but they certainly are required to comply under the law.
Thank you. My second question is, as a totally blind person, bathrooms are absolutely horrible. And I think it's dangerous for us because we have to touch everywhere. Yeah. And it's so unsanitary. And I don't understand what the code is or how we can get some kind of something going on for bathrooms. Thank you.
It's an interesting question. And, you know, that's a design question, I would say, to be honest. And one of the things we take issue with in restrooms is, you know, we have a really good opportunity in plan review to affect change in new construction. It's existing facilities that are more problematic. And one of the things we often see in existing facilities is paper towel dispensers, hand dryers that are installed right around a corner so that when a person walking into the room walks in, they will walk directly into that and make body contact, slam into it with their shoulder, right, or their head, or who knows what. And we've told, you know, we tell all of our clients consistently these things, that's a code violation. A lot of people say to us, though, a lot of designers especially, say, well, you know, in a restroom, everything's a protruding hazard, so I don't think those are protruding hazards. So we have that argument with them really often, but they certainly aren't issues. So I would recommend that you try to become involved in the process when your facilities are being altered and try to become part of the group that has input on that, because I think that your views would be more valuable than you realize. See, I don't think it's that designers don't want to comply or that they don't like access or they don't think it's a good idea. I don't think they understand it. I think most of them have no idea. They're not walking into things all the time, are they? Like people with vision impairments. They don't experience these things, and so they don't understand how important they are. Once they do, their perspective oftentimes changes, and the way in which they design facilities tends to change as well. Any other questions? Oh, three more. Sorry.
And then that will be it, the three.
Okay. We're down to two now. This is the last of the three, but the two in the front, you're still coming up.
My name is Stephanie. I have a question, but I think it's probably more of something that needs to be put as a standard to the signage companies and not necessarily those installing them, as I suspect that the signage is done, like you said, in different bits and pieces. The tactile raised numbering on many signages for room numbers is correct, but a lot of times the Braille signage on that very same sign is incorrect. And I've seen this down in another hotel I stayed in, San Diego, 2 weeks ago. Seen it here at this hotel. In other buildings, in other places. And another place I even find them, which I don't think follows under your code, is the signage that is in cabs. The raised signage has the correct car number. The Braille signage does not. That's the first comment. My second comment is about the tactile tiles. I work at the VA hospital at a blind rehabilitation center. Some of the clients are visually impaired with walkers, rollator type walkers, and if their vision is poor, too poor, they don't grant them an electric chair. And some of them are too weak to go over those tiles at the crosswalk. Many times I've had to push them across that area because they can't get lined up. I can't see well enough to line them up, so I end up pushing them. And finally, just as a very brief comment, I worked at another agency before who one of the clients was a student and complained about the steps. They are curved, shallow steps that went a great distance across the front of the building, and the concrete was gray, and they put a blue-gray or green-gray stripe, which nobody could see. And she complained they got them changed to yellow. As soon as she graduated, they changed it back to green.
You know, my personal favorite for contrasting color was in a very high-end theater that we assessed a number of years ago, and the stairways were carpeted in a blood red color, and the contrasting color was deep green. So they figured it's a contrast, which is true, but for people with color blindness, red-green color blindness, for example, there was no contrast at all. And in the darkness of a theater, there was still no contrast. So they meant well. It cost them a lot of money to inset that green stripe into that carpeting on each stairway tread, but it was still wrong. So, her question?
Let me just comment. Also, unfortunately, you mentioned it's a VA facility, federal government, therefore it doesn't have to comply with the Title 24 for the stair striping. So that is an unfortunate thing that the feds haven't gotten enlightened as to the need for them. Yes. So California, again, is the only state that has the stair striping for public stairways, where, yes, they're in the National Fire Protection Association does and ANSI have requirements on aisle stairs for the striping things, but the regular stairways, California has it. Other states, like our affiliate in Tennessee, is trying to get something in their building code through the legislative process. And so that is something we are ahead. And people back in Washington are not all that excited about the stair striping because of aesthetics. That's reality.
You know, he's absolutely right about that. And even in the ADA standards, the contrasting color is an advisory. It's not a requirement. So we have clients in other states that depend upon the ADA standards, and they don't implement California Building Code, of course, right? And so we try our best to convince them to use that advisory as a standard. And it's an inexpensive thing to do, and at least at exterior stairways where they can paint the stairways, fairly inexpensive, yet it has a huge effect upon not just people with disabilities, but it's a risk management issue. You know, we try to explain to our clients, risk management should be part of your viewpoint or your perspective when it comes to accessibility, because they go hand in hand. Because if people are injuring themselves because your facilities aren't accessible, because you have protruding objects, because you don't have detectable warnings where they're necessary, it's not just an ADA issue. It's going to be a lawsuit of risk management proportion. So think in those terms. And they are oftentimes more receptive to that, sadly, but you know, we try our best to affect change in any way we can. So we had two more questions in the front still. Go ahead.
Okay. This is Charlene Ornelas, and my first one is, when you have a grandstand, it has an overhang because there's a floor up above. Technically, it's outside, and it would be on the aisle stairs. Is it required there to have the stripe on all stairs?
Yes.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah, we do a lot of work with universities, and so their stadiums, all of their softball fields, their baseball fields, all of those bleachers have issues when it comes to the stairways, the bleachers, and then accessible integrated seating, not just accessible seating at one side or the other. Okay, one last question.
Okay, I have two more real quick ones.
Okay.
One is, there's all these check-in kiosks that are being used at airports, at doctor's offices. They're flat screen. Is there a requirement for it to be accessible tactily?
Yeah, right now, no. We're talking, you know, what I was describing in code is about fare vending machines, point of sale machines. There are requirements for those, but this, what you're talking about, you're talking about a kiosk.
Yes.
An information kiosk. Yeah, it probably should come eventually. And one thing I will tell you is this, okay, I'm not encouraging litigation by any means, but a lot of the things we are able to see in code now are a result of case law precedent, which meant someone at some point sued because of an issue and a judge ruled that the code wasn't applied properly or wasn't expansive enough or didn't serve the rights of people with disabilities properly. And so a lot of what we do for our clients is explain case law to them. So this may very well be something that comes out of case law that is let's say, hastened by these new changes for point-of-sale machines. That's what I would predict, actually.
Okay, my third question, which is my last one, is because of the gaming casinos being on Indian reservations, are the reservations exempt from ADA, or do they need to comply?
They're a nation unto themselves, so they're totally exempt. One last question, Christianing person in the front, yeah? He's getting to you right now with the microphone.
Well, I have many questions, actually, but are you going to be here after the meeting?
I am, for a bit of time. I'm not at lunch, but a bit after that I could be.
Great, because I would like to talk to you after that. But one of my questions that I want to know is there a code for the seam lines on sidewalks? As you know, you're walking down a sidewalk, if you can imagine this table being a sidewalk, and I'm walking towards my right here, and there's seam lines going across. And I found in San Diego, walking through a downtown neighborhood, they accidentally put a seam line right down the middle, and it became the best tactile for my cane. Is there a code for that?
I will tell you, it's probably a score line or an expansion joint, one of the two. A score line, simply because when you're pouring concrete and troweling it, it's a customary practice, an industry standard practice to score at 5, 6, or 8, perhaps, or 10-foot lengths. But expansion joints are placed between pads to allow changes for the heat, the freeze and thaw cycle, basically. So, no, you know, those are construction things that happen that have to happen for constructability reasons. But, yeah, one thing about code, too, code does not speak to horizontal changes. It speaks to vertical changes.
Yeah, I was just wondering, it's such a simple thing,
But keep in mind, for example, there was a code requirement for a short time where a curb ramp required a half-inch lip at the flow line, and that was for readability for people with white canes, but it also stopped wheelchairs and flipped people out of their chairs, and so it was removed from code. So there's always a give and take between groups of people with disabilities and their needs and how they can best serve the greater population. So that change in code, which was intended to help people with vision impairments, was a big, big problem for people that use chairs. So that's the problem with detectable warnings. You always have to weigh them. Are they going to become a trip hazard? For example, one of the places that is a big deal that people always have an issue with is when you have a path of travel along a vehicular traffic lane, which could be hazardous, may not be hazardous, but in many instances they are because it's an area where there's no line of sight around a curve, for example. And in California, you have to put detectable warnings along that edge. Well, that's usually a flush edge, so you have a walkway that's flush, and then it goes out into roadway, or not roadway necessarily, but oftentimes parking lot. Well, putting those truncated domes in, it's not the most readable thing. A more readable thing would be a curb, but you know what? Everyone would trip over that curb, and so they're not going to put a curb in because people would trip over it, and cars would drive over it and crumble it over time, and so then they're going to have a maintenance issue long-term that they're going to have to replace over and over again, so the client is going to have a big issue with a curb, even though the curb would be best for people with vision impairments, wouldn't be so great for people that are sighted that just trip a lot like me, because I trip over that curb. So see, there's going to always have to be give and take between these groups to make sure that the greatest good is achieved for the largest number of the population. Does that make sense? Okay.
Gene? Yeah. Angel? Got it. Yeah. I'm just going to take it. Just closing comment, and that is, as Rune accurately said, there was issues about the beveled half-inch beveled lip on the curb ramp, and you know initially we were fighting that, and fortunately because of work that started in Sacramento. Eventually, we got detectable warnings, which there's tremendous about research that shows they're effective. We got something far superior in the long run. The domes are only 0.2 high, and the code for elevation changes along walkways is a quarter inch. So they're lower than what the code says that they can be. So there's, you know, it's the trade-off, and unfortunately, sometimes people's mobility limitations are so severe that unless it's a flat surface, they're not going to be able to go over any of the actual terrain, walkways, and so forth. And so there is, as Savin said, there is going to be a 18-month cycle starting in January of 2017. The Division of State Architect that has the responsibility for Chapter 11B, a Title 24 Part 2, is now starting to consider what things to introduce. They don't want to put a lot. They usually wait and it'll be the next three-year code cycle. But this afternoon, the Committee on Access and Transportation will be meeting at 4:15. And I'm drawing a blank where we're meeting. I don't have a program. But that we will be talking about ideas. And so you're welcome to come and to see what things we might want to introduce Division State Architect. Now, let's give a hand to Sarun for an exceptional, excellent job. You have no idea of the challenge she faced putting the code into really layman's terms. She's done an incredible job, and I really want to thank you for the detail. It was excellent and very valuable. Sycamore 1 is the meeting at 4:15 this afternoon. Thank you very much. And again, let's give Sarun a hand. Okay. You might be able to get her afterwards, but we have no more questions for this segment. We're behind, and we're now going to move into Caltrans ADA project update. We've had some changes in our presenters, but we're very pleased to introduce Katharina Barros. Thank you. Who is an ADA engineer under the ADA office at Caltrans. Teresa Gabriel. And Teresa, I don't have the little bit of information, but you are a certified engineer, if I recall, and you are branch chief of the electrical. Well, I'll let you office title. And Teresa and I go back, about 20 years or so, learning about working on accessible pedestrian signal requirements for the California Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices. And we went through the California Traffic Control Devices Committee meetings, and eventually some of those things came out in the Manual and Uniform Traffic Control Devices, as they both will talk about. So to save time, I will turn it over to them, and they're going to talk about different aspects about the ADA office and the grievance process for ADA complaints, and this is for Caltrans only, and APS requirements that are in the California Manual Uniform Traffic Control Devices, how to make requests, and their policies and procedures that Caltrans has for APSs. So I will turn it over to them.
Thank you. Thank you, Jean, and thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak to everyone today. My name is Katrina Barros, and I am a civil engineer with Caltrans. I have been with the department since 1987. So I've worked in a variety of departments throughout the state. As Jean said, I'm here with Teresa, and I'm going to give a very broad sort of 10,000-foot overview of the ADA department, and Teresa will definitely get more into the details regarding the APS installations. So just a brief apology, Marcella, who was supposed to speak, she is recovering from surgery, so she is out for a couple of weeks. However, I will be able to address any issues that you may have. So we've recently reorganized the ADA program. We used to be under the Division of Maintenance, and now we are under the Office of Business and Economic Opportunity. And we call that, we like to use a lot of acronyms at Caltrans, so we call that OBEO. We are right down the street from the Sacramento office of the California Council for the Blind. We're right at 14th and R, so we are neighbors. The acting director of OBEO, her name is Janice Solis, and she reports directly to Malcolm Dougherty, who is the director of Caltrans. So it is directly under his line of purview, so to speak. The current ADA program manager, her name is Elizabeth Dewar, and I report directly to Elizabeth. We have a staff of three other people, Marcella and Brianna Peluso, who is responsible for our contract management, and Olga Baruman, who takes care of the FHWA compliance reviews. Now, for those that don't understand Caltrans, you know, we're a big organization, and we cover the whole state. So in headquarters in Sacramento, we often act as a corporate policy-making function. So while our OBEO, our ADA group is small, what we try to do is guide the policy and support the district in developing projects. Now, what I talk about when I talk about districts, you know, the state of California is big, and we have 12 districts throughout the state. And right now, where we are would be considered District 11, which is the San Diego County, Imperial County. And each district has their own ADA liaison and their own ADA engineer. So what we try to do in headquarters is guide policy and help these folks in the district deliver the projects appropriately and give them the financial support, quite frankly, and the policy support to make sure they can deliver effective products. Now, part of the reason I have to explain this is, you know, the state of California is diverse, so each district's like their own little kingdom with their own personalities. And so we try to guide, and we definitely try to strongly encourage, and we do have a little hammer in the sense that we can direct funding. However, each district is responsible for their own sort of microcosm and their own transportation programs in that district. So we all have to work in partnership with one another to develop the best product for the state of California and all its stakeholders. So part of our policy and our advisory group, we deal with other divisions and headquarters, and we deal with design, who does all the design policy. We deal with traffic operations, who take care of traffic safety and electrical. And we deal with maintenance, who are some of the people that may have to go out and do some of these repairs that are done for these, you know, for some of the grievances. We deal with construction. So it's this multi-partnering effort to try to get everything done. So I'm just giving you a little perspective of what we kind of deal with in day in, day out. So as I said, we deal with the districts. Now, as a lot of you know, Caltrans has agreed to spend $1.1 billion over the next 30 years to remove access barriers. And this agreement started back in 2010. And these access barriers include things like installing curb ramps, upgrading non-compliant curb ramps, repairing broken and uneven pavement on pedestrian facilities, correcting non-compliant cross slopes, removal of protruding or overhanging objects or obstructions, and, you know, installing APSs. So when Caltrans does projects, anytime we alter existing facilities, and facilities meaning roadways, not buildings, every time we alter these existing facilities, we are obligated to upgrade to ADA standards. Now, this is something we do anyway. What this money that we have allocated to spend over the next 30 years, this is in addition to that. So these are purely ADA improvements. So just to give you an example, in 2014-15, Caltrans completed 15 projects valued at $20.7 million, and these were all just ADA improvements. So this basically covered 296 curb ramps, a mile and a half of sidewalk, and installing 196 accessible pedestrian signals. Now, what we face as a challenge with the department is some of these designs are very, they're a little more complex. Even though it is a curb ramp, we have existing conditions that we have to sort of accommodate, and that has been quite challenging for us. Now, I think as a department, we're getting a lot better at it, and so we've had a lot of lessons learned. Now, in the next few years, we are going to be spending, for 15 and 16, for example, we have access contracts valued at $23.1 million. And this amount is going to increase up to $68.6 million in 2018 and 2019. So we plan on expending the resources that we need to spend. Now, what's a little, another challenge that we face is the way Caltrans programs its projects. Now, all these ADA projects are covered under what's called the State Highway Operations and Protection Program, and another acronym, we call it the SHOP. But the SHOP also covers improvements such as pavement rehab, bridge rehab, culvert repairs, slip-out repairs, safety projects, and these are just a few of the things that are all the projects that are covered in the SHOP. Now, again, you know, I don't want to overwhelm you with information, but this is a little bit of the framework that we have to deal with. And a SHOP project, what we can initiate a project this year, but because of the funding and depending, you know, on environmental, right-of-way, these kind of aspects, this project may not actually go to construction for another 2 or 3 years. Now, fortunately, we have some more streamlined processes that can ensure delivery in perhaps maybe 2 years, but this is all the balance that we have to work with in trying to get, honestly, the best bang for the buck. So if the best bang for the buck is addressing 300 barriers
3 years from now versus 10 barriers 2 years from now? Well, as a department, we have to make, you know, a prudent decision. So that's a little bit of the big picture regarding how Caltrans takes care of ADA projects. Now, as far as grievances, for example, last year we had 128 grievances, and what we do for grievances is currently Caltrans is intaking all grievances. So what we have to do is we have to speak to the grievant, we have to take in the information. Now, there's a couple of ways people can file grievances. Basically, you can call us, you can talk to us. Brianna and Olga have talked to quite a few people regarding their grievances. The number is 866-810-6346. We will need your contact information so we can keep you appraised of the status of your grievance. Or you can go online, and we have a webpage, dot.ca.gov, and you will see there is the online service tab, and under it is the ADA access service request, and this takes you to the ADA infrastructure program. Now, we've had some changes in the program, and it'll say report an access barrier, and then it'll say submit a maintenance service request. So that is another alternative of filing a grievance, but you can always call. Now, once we get the grievance, what we have to do is Caltrans has to determine whether or not it's our problem. Because sometimes it is a local agency or it could be a private entity and it is not Caltrans. Now, what we will do is we will let the grievant know this isn't ours. However, we have forwarded your request to the appropriate entity. Now, that's where our hands are a little bit tied, because we can report it to a county or a city, but it is up to them to act. So now, then it becomes their issue, and they're going to have to pursue it appropriately. Now, we as Caltrans will contact the grievant and say, hey, we talked to the city of so-and-so, and you know, we've told them of your concern. Now, what I've seen happen is sometimes the city doesn't follow up on it. Now, we'd like to be able to control that, but honestly, that's where you kind of go back to the ADA coordinator in that city and file the complaint, or if you need to, you go back to the Department of Justice. It's just, you know, that's the process. So, now, if it is our jurisdiction, then we contact that ADA engineer that's in the geographical area, and we ask them, okay, this is our grievance, what are we going to do about it? And so the ADA engineer and the ADA liaison look at the projects programmed, or they look and see what they can do, and really, I think they try to do the best they can do given what they're given. So they come back to us, and they give us a proposed resolution. Now, as a department, we are obligated to inform the grievant within 180 days of the proposed resolution. Now, it's not 180 days that it gets built. It's 180 days that, okay, this is what we plan on doing. This is the project we plan on initiating. Now, I know all of these district engineers try as best as they can to get these resolved in a timely manner, but like I alluded to before, sometimes these projects are already in the pipeline or there's something already planned to take care of it. So we try to look at all the options available to us, and we really do try to deal with these in the most expeditious manner. Okay, so those are my comments just basically on the organization and the grievances. I know Teresa has quite a bit to talk about regarding the APS and the installation. I'm assuming we're going to take questions at the end? Okay. All right, so I'm going to turn it over to Teresa, and she will talk about the APS.
Thank you, Katrina, and thank you, Eugene, for inviting me to allow Caltrans to talk about the APS. So Let me talk briefly about myself. I started with Caltrans in 1985, about 31 years ago. I worked a little bit in different offices between the Bay Area and Sacramento. Currently, I'm in Sacramento headquarters. I worked with the timing and programming the traffic signals. Then I moved to the actual design of traffic signals and electrical system, other different electrical system. And now I'm responsible for the department specification for the electrical specification, including the APS. Of course, you know that we love acronyms. So the APS is the Accessible Pedestrian Signal Device. Typically, we are following the federal manual. Everybody can say, well, what's MUTCD? What's California MUTCD? What is that? Another acronym. MUTCD stands for Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Device. And this is the federal manual that applies to all states. California MUTCD is the federal manual with some changes that applies to California, okay? And it applies to all local agencies as well as Caltrans. Sometimes Caltrans goes above and beyond because of our standards, guidelines, and manuals. So what I'm going to talk about it right now is the California MUTCD. The California MUTCD Chapter 4 is related to, or it talks about the electrical traffic signal and other application like flashing beacon and so forth. Section 4E is a whole section for the accessible pedestrian signal system. Okay, there are about five subsections that talks about the accessible pedestrian signal system. The manual on uniform traffic control device, as well as the California manual on uniform traffic control device, is available and accessible online. If you can go to the Caltrans website, go to the traffic operation, and it should be there. The section 4E talks briefly about pedestrian detector, and it provides an option to use either push button, which is regular circle button that anybody can push it, or it could be a passive device. A passive device, we're talking about a type of a passive device is the accessible pedestrian signal system. So as for the California MUTCD and for the local agencies, cities and counties, it is optional to be used. I'm just going to include the topic for Caltrans policies and process and installation. In the same time, I'm talking about the difference between the local agencies and Caltrans, so you can see the difference. So the local agency has an option to install the accessible pedestrian signal system. Caltrans policy and updated memo starting, it started with in 2012 and it was also updated in 2014. Now it is the pedestrian detector of use to be installed at all new traffic signal system, as well as any pedestrian detectors for any other application, for example, the in-roadway warning light, the pedestrian hybrid beacon, the rapid rectangular flashing beacon. Wherever the pedestrian is going to need a detector, the new installation must be the accessible pedestrian signal system. One section talks about where that pedestrian detector should be located. It should be located between 1.5 foot from the edge of curb all the way maximum to 5 feet. Because typically if it is within that range, if it is more than that, it is kind of difficult for any pedestrian to take the time and go beyond 5 feet and activate the pedestrian detector to be able to cross. The height, it's between 3.5 foot maximum 4 feet. Caltrain's requirement is 40 inches, which is 3.5. Basically, to allow if there is any adjustment vertically for curb or whatever, to make sure that we are compliant with the California MUTCD. Now, not every intersection is going to be similar, and there are sometimes physical constraints. So the code, the California MUTCD, or MUTCD in short, allows, if there are many constraints, you can go up to maximum 10 feet. But we try hard to make it maximum 5 feet. Now, where there are two pedestrian detectors in one corner, there should be separated by 10 feet. Sometimes they are on the same pole, signal pole, and we will talk about the requirement for that, what will happen when it is two of them on the same pole, especially for Caltrans, because we are talking about the accessible pedestrian signal system. Another requirement when we install the accessible pedestrian signal, or APS for short, we will have to install signs to mounted adjacent to or immediately above and integral with the pedestrian push button to explain the purpose and use. The signs, the different type of signs to be used for the pedestrians, they are in Chapter 2 of the California MUTCD. So let's say if there is any intersection where it is wide geometric and there are a median in the middle of the intersection, if you're going to cross from one end to the other, the recommendation is to place the pedestrian push button or the APS in the median. Another section talks about the actual APS. What is the APS? What makes it different from the pedestrian push button? In the past, the pedestrian push button is just a button that you push it and it communicates with the computer that runs the traffic signal for the green indication for the vehicles and for pedestrian for the walk and don't walk. And it communicates that there is a need, for example, for the north and south direction to cross the intersection, or east and west, or whatever the direction. The difference of the APS that is more user-friendly and more accessible to pedestrian with mobility impairment is it talks about more features. And I call it, okay, so A, P, and S. A for audible tones, P is for, it's kind of like reminding myself what is P, is for speech messages, and the S is for sign vibrating message, vibrating arrows to tell the user what is the indication on it. So typically, in the California MUTCD, I will talk about the California MUTCD first. It provides a recommendation where the APS is needed. It recommends to be supported by an engineering study. And it also recommends some training to be involved by the local agencies. And because the funding for the adding the accessible pedestrian signal system, we intend to include the local agency to participate in the funding. And the limits of the funding is based on the geometric. If it is, for example, a T intersection, the ratio is going to be 1:3 to the owner of the two legs versus one leg, or a four-leg intersection is going to be possibly 50-50. Having said that, in the past, there has been some difficulties, and it depends upon the local agency's type of funding. So there is a if there is a difficulty to get the funding from the local agency, there is a possibility that the department will take the lead to make sure that if there is a device is needed to provide accessible access for pedestrian with movement impairment, we will take care of it and the funding will come in secondly. So it talks about the location where the APS could be installed, near blind centers, senior centers, transit terminals, T-type intersection, wide intersection, a lot of location that they are listed in the California MUTCD. Now, if I compare this with the Caltrans regulation, it is the policy now that any new intersection to be installed, it is going to automatically include the APS as part of the traffic signal design. What about modification of existing traffic signals? With modification traffic signals, we used to have a requirement, if it is more than 50%, then you can include this or that. No more. If it is going to be a modification, the requirement for the designer is to include the accessible pedestrian signal system, 50% or not. If there is any modification, this is what they will do. It also consider if there is a request to, let's say that I don't have any modification, but there is a request from public to include the APS. They will consider it, and they will see what's the next project that is going to go in this area that will include electrical or no electrical, and they will consider adding the APS. Or if there will be, they will also consider the funding available. Katrina talked about the funding that is already set up to comply with the ADA to have more accessible. So moving forward for the next section, it talks about the location. It's preferred to have a 10 feet separation between the two pedestrian standard where each accessible pedestrian signal system is going to be installed. What is the speech and when to, which type of speech we're talking about, what's the tactile, and how does it relate to the signal timing? Typically, the accessible pedestrian signal system is incorporated as part of the pedestrian detector, meaning that once it is activated, it will notify the computer that run the traffic signal that there is a need for pedestrian crossings. And the pedestrian crossing typically, it has not been changed. There is a timing for the walk. Typically, the California MUTCD, it provides a requirement between, the minimum is 4 second walk to up to 7 second walk. The majority, if not all, the traffic signals typically adopt 7 second walk for the intersection, and the flashing downwalk, the flashing hand, the upraised hand, is based on the distance for the pedestrian to travel. So it starts with the beginning of the curb all the way to the middle of the last lane. Then the timing, the countdown of the flashing downwalk or the flashing upraised hand, it will stop, and then it will time the the yellow. The yellow timing, it depends minimum 3 seconds all the way to 5 seconds or so, depending on the speed. The intersection typically is evaluated by there has been a change in the California MUTCD. We used to include the speed of the walk was based to how to determine the timing for the flashing dawn walk was based on 4 feet per second. Considering lots of needs, myself, my speed is kind of like very much hindered. I'm slow walker now. So it did incorporate lots of needs between students, between older citizens, between people with needs. So now the speed is not more than 3.5 feet per second, which provided longer time to cross the intersection during the flashing dawn walk. So what is the message to be used? If we are talking about two push button or two accessible pedestrian signal on each corner, if they are separated with at least 10 feet, so they are 10 feet apart on one corner, it was found that it is very useful and to use an ambiguous speed tick, so eight tick per second, or six to eight tick per second. It was found per the ADA guidelines that it provides more unambiguous information to the pedestrian. So there is one sound for them to cross for that. Let's say for north and south, and another speed. Let's say this one is 6 to 10 feet per second on the north and south, and another speed for that tick sound on the east and west direction to identify for the pedestrian user which direction they are talking about. Now, if we are having a distance that it is less than 10 feet apart, then it may be confusing, and the pedestrian needs to know how which direction is coming from, which one they need to cross. So where the or even if they if there are two APS located on the same pole, so which one is going to direct the pedestrian to which crossing first? The arrow, the vibrating arrow on the push button, it will have to direct, it will have to be aligned with the direction of the crosswalk. This is one thing. The other thing is it will have to be a message, an audible message. So if we are talking, for example, an intersection Broadway with Main Street, so it will just start with the recommended message in one pattern, walk the Broadway intersection or Broadway crossing, crossing Main Street is on. So the information provided in the California MUTCD is being adopted by the Department Standard Specification for the APS. So whatever is in the California MUTCD is already telling the manufacturer, this is what you have to comply with, and this is what we're going to, the contractor, when they install it, they have to make sure that it is tested. The if there is a noisy intersection, this is something we, about the engineering study. Sometime in the intersection, especially where there is a very high right turn on red, it's difficult to decipher the movement of the vehicle because of the vehicle. There are more vehicles now than there are quieter. So, or a low volume traffic during the peak hour, and it is understood that the pedestrian with mobility impairment, they are listening to the movement of the traffic waiting for the onset green so they can start crossing. So that's why the traffic engineering study, to make sure to see what other needs that they need to address and train the pedestrian to use this intersection. Okay? So going back to the accessible pedestrian signal system requirement, so it must be at least five decibel above the intersection, but not that loud, because to avoid confusing the pedestrian with other noise, because they need to hear what the surrounding and how the movement are going. So these all are requirement for in the California MUTCD. In the past, we did not have it incorporated and addressed in the specification. The specification, the electrical specification, have been completely rewritten to make sure that if there is a requirement to the construction, during construction, or to the contractor to check, we made it clear and spelled it out for the contractor. We want the contractor to test the APS in the presence of the inspector to make sure that it performs properly, and it must adjust accordingly, automatically, to the ambient noise. So if it is a high peak time, then it should be a little bit higher. If it is off peak time, instead of annoying the surrounding residents, because that has been a problem in the past, if the residents are kind of like, if the device that does not adjust automatically to the ambient noise, they will complain, they will ask Caltrans, do something about it, take it out. So we are putting the burden on the contractor. We want to make sure that the device must be compliant to the requirement in the California MUTCD. There are the other feature is the tactile arrows. So once you activate the button, it will tell you if it is not the proper time to cross and the conflicting movement is on, you will hear this message, wait. This is the one of the speech message that will provide the message to the pedestrian during the non-crossing time. And during the crossing time, it will provide the message, either the tick, 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 the noise, or if the two push button or the two APS, they are less than 10 feet apart, it will provide the message, walk, Broadway crossing at Main Street is on, okay? There is also another feature as part of the APS, which is the locator tone, meaning that it's a tone that it will, it's different than the walk tone, the speech tone. It will provide tick, 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 meaning that if you are approaching the intersection, you should be able to identify the location where that APS is located at that corner. Okay, so that's the tactile arrows and the locator tone. The California MUTCD also provides some features or possibilities. It's called extended push button press feature. This one is defined as if used, if it is called for, then if you press the button or depress the APS for less than 1 or 2 seconds, the original timing allowed for or programmed for the walk and don't walk is going to proceed. But if you need to activate the extended push button press feature, you will need to push the button for more than 3 seconds. The extended feature, it's either one of the following: either increase the timing of the walk or don't walk, or activate a beaconing for the device, or it explain or activate an explanation or description of the road. It's a message describing more description of the roadway. Okay, this particular feature, it is not used in the Caltrans operated APS, and it is typically because of the fact that the computer or the controller running the intersection, it is typically programmed by the designer, by the operation, traffic signal operation operator, based on the need of the intersection itself. Having said that, if you feel there is a need to adjust the timing, you used it a couple of times, you feel that you need more timing, you are very well encouraged to contact the district traffic engineer, and they will work out they will consider the request for the timing. We try as best for the traffic signal operation person. We are here in District 11, San Diego, and also there are lots of districts where there are a lot of traffic, and we are trying to avoid the stop-and-go situation for vehicles. So we try our best to synchronize the timing between close located intersection to try to reduce the congestion, reduce the timing, and minimize the gases outputted from the exhaustion. So we try as best, as much as we can, to try to coordinate the traffic in different arterial, even if it is interrupted by other owned traffic signals, for example, the on-ramp and off-ramp terminals. They are signalized and they are state signals, but there is a lot of arterial traffic signals, so we coordinate with the local agencies, cities and counties. So that's why we try as best take care of the vehicles traveling, minimizing the congestion, as well as taking care of the timing needed for the pedestrian to cross. So having said that, I have a question that I encounter in while working and updating the standards. Before I ask the question and present it to the to Jean as the president, or I want an answer. Not it does not need to be today, but please get back to me. But I just want to make sure that I covered all the needed topics. I covered what is the California MUTCD provisions for the accessible pedestrian signal system between, and the differences between the locals and cities and counties and Caltrans. And I discussed the Caltrans policies and process. Regarding APS request, we welcome any request, and we will consider it. It is best to provide the question to the districts. Typically, in headquarters, I work with all 12 districts in California. And if there is any questions, they coordinate with me. We work together. We update the policy. We update the standards based on the needs, and based to make it easier for everybody to be able to use it. Installation, I did not address that. In the past, in the 2012, it included a requirement that once the APS is installed, it, unless there is a definite need for it, it must be deactivated until such a need is called for. The 2014 update, once the APS is installed, it must be activated as part of the project. So the installation and activation, it is mandated for all new traffic signals and all new modified traffic signals. And any application to be used by pedestrians, signalized or not, they call it now, the California MUTCD, they call traffic signal is a controlled application. Controlled application. Controlled application meaning that you should be able to hear the walk signal or timing or message and the upraised hand. So other application that is considered controlled traffic, controlled application beside the traffic signal is the pedestrian hybrid beacon. Pedestrian hybrid beacon, it goes from dark to flashing to solid red for the vehicles. And part of the design, it includes pedestrian signal indication with the walk and upraised hand, the walking symbol and upraised hand. So once there is a signal indication for pedestrian, it is considered controlled application, and the use of the APS is mandatory, okay? Now, uncontrolled application, meaning the in-roadway warning light, you push also the accessible pedestrian signal system, and it will activate a light for the crossings for the vehicle to yield the right-of-way to the pedestrian using that intersection. It's called in-roadway warning light. There is a new application that it was introduced recently. It's called the rectangular rapid flashing beacon, which is a sign for pedestrian and a crossings for pedestrian, but there is no pedestrian signal indication on it. It provides, it has a beacon that it is flashes with a similar frequency to the ambulance driver to get the attention of the driver to, once it is activated, that flashing beacon will be activated, and it gets the attention of the driver, and there has been quite a few installation. Again, even though that there is no pedestrian signal indication, the use or the pedestrian detector is the accessible pedestrian signal system. That is the end of my presentation, and my question is, if there is an intersection where all four corners, northeast, for example, and southeast, and north and south, and east and west, all four corners, they are enough separation for the pedestrian detector to be installed. So the recommendation from the California MUTCD is to use a percussive tone. Tick, 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 not the speech message. It's a percussive tone with different speed. Now, if there is one corner that it is less than 10 feet, to avoid ambiguity, the message to pedestrian must be an audible Broadway crossing Main Street. So I ran into a situation where, what do you want to have if there is only one corner of the intersection that it is going to have difficulty, geometric difficulty, to put that two pedestrian detector in within separated by 10 feet. So that particular corner will have to use the message, the audible message, crossing Broadway at Main Street. If I am going to apply the concept of the, what about the rest of the three corner, should I use also the audible message, or should I apply a percussive tone? If I apply a percussive tone, there is a possibility that if I'm crossing from north-south, from the north corner to the south corner on the same direction, I am starting with a message crossing Broadway at Main Street, and halfway, or maybe even not halfway, if I have only two lanes to cross, I'm faced two continuous percussive tones. Is this going to be confusing, or? So my understanding, my interpretation, if I'm going to change one corner, that will apply to the rest of the corners to avoid confusion. But the final decision, I will hear it from you, and it's up to you to take your time and let me know with an email. That will be great. Thank you, everyone. If there is any other question.
Okay. Let's see. Yeah. Is this okay? Yeah. Well, it's getting there. We will get back to you. That's a very interesting question, and there's a lot of different opinions on it, so we will talk about it. But I want to ask, if I understood correctly, and I'm talking about Caltrans only, but the policy, not the locals, the option there for the extended press for the wait to cross Broadway at Main, basically this identification of the leg that you're at and the intersection, what would be the process, because I know you can't commit to anything, what would be the process that we would follow to try to see that that option be a standard for Caltrans policy-wise? I know for the locals, we'd have to go through the California Traffic Devices Control Committee, which would be we would have to do separately. But what would be the process that we could ask Caltrans policy to be modified again to have that extended press for the announcement? Because street intersection signage is really important, and that is an easy way for getting it. Did that make sense?
Yes. Thank you, Jean. Okay. Here is what I would do. You do not need to go to the California Traffic Control Device Committee to include it, because it is already part of the California MUTCD and is already part of the manual on Uniform Traffic Control Device Committee. So it is already accepted. You do need to go to the CTCDC or the California Traffic Control Device Committee if you need to include something additional, something that is not already currently in the California MUTCD. So the extended feature is already in the MUTCD.
But it's an option right now for the announcement.
The option is to use the APS for the local agencies. It is not a mandated use for all traffic signals. In the MUTCD and the California MUTCD, it is an option. Caltrans went above and beyond and adopted a policy that it is going to be the practice to be used at all traffic signals. Now, if what you are interested in the description of the crossing, and this is an easy answer, because before I came in, I wanted to make sure if there is a feasibility to incorporate this as part of the software of the computer running the intersection, and I was told that it is not feasible at the with the department standard controller assembly that is running the intersection. So the next question is, yes, I would like to use the message crossing Broadway at Main Street instead of the percussive tone. And that's an easy solution. You just, now, if I'm a district designer, I have to comply with the California MUTCD, and if it is more than 10 feet, then I need to use the percussive tone. Well, if I am in a district and I received at one location, hey, I need to use the actual message, then it is going to be an easy question for the district designer and traffic signal operation person, change the programming for this particular location to a description of the crossing. That is no problem. Actually, I'll have to say this while discussing with all the 12 districts, and every district is kind of unique in the needs and the people and how do they activate it. I received a call from one of our traffic signal operation engineer in Orange County, and they said, well, I do not want to use the message. It's confusing. The area where I'm going to install the traffic signals is in nearby Saigon City, and there are lots of people that they may not be able to understand it clearly. So they need to be able to use it, but not by the message. And I said, well, you know what? It is allowed to use the manufacturer. They know that they need to provide an option to use either a percussive tones with different speeds to identify different direction crossing or a message. So it is up to the districts and up to the need of the people who are going to be using that intersection.
Okay.
Does it make sense?
Yeah, and I'll talk to you both more about it.
Sure.
Online. I'm going to let you, but before you both depart, of course, we're going to have questions right now for you, but I want your business cards, please, too, just before I forget.
Of course.
Okay. Now, people would raise their hands, so somebody, can you get a mic to you?
That's the old one.
Hi, Teresa. I got a question for you. This is a problem I encounter in noisy, busy intersections, especially when there's a diesel vehicle on my left and it wants to make a right turn or it's either going to go straight. Is there some kind of automatic volume control on these? Because sometimes I can't even hear the traffic when there's a diesel vehicle next to me, so I depend more on the audible system. Is there something that automatically raises the volume as noise is in their intersection and lowers it back down? Or is there something that we could press to up the volume just for that one crossing and then automatically goes back to its normal sounding?
Okay, the question if there is a requirement if to automatically raise the volume or not. It is part of the requirement in the California MUTCD to be able to make sure that in normal operation, the tone must be at least a minimum of 5 decibel above the surrounding noise, and it should be automatically reacting to the surrounding the ambient noise up to a maximum of 100 decibel. So I'll have to be honest with you. When we installed, we've been installing the APS for quite some time, and we've been asking the specification has been kind of like, yes, install it and test it, install it and test it. So has it been tested during construction? I do not know. I do not think so. But right now, the specification, the electrical specification, by the way, it will be posted in April 15. It's still reserved at this time. We missed the deadline. But it is telling the contractor clearly that they have to test it in the presence of the engineer. So it is direct information to the contractor and the engineer, even if they are not electrical, that they have to test it and accept it or not. If it does not accept it, then they will have to change it. And we ask them to use a device to measure the ambient noise, and so that is a requirement. But we are limited to a maximum of 100 decibel, and that's a standard here. So that's what I'm asking here. Another question. Next question.
Hello. Yes, I wanted to thank you for putting APS in Rohnert Park, California. I applied, I think, during the 2013-2014, and we were one of the areas that you looked over and approved it, because it had two entrances to a freeway, a 101 highway, and so we thank you for that.
Thank you. I'll have to provide the credit to change the existing policy to all traffic signals. I cannot take the credit for it. It's the ADA group, our ADA headquarters ADA group, that they should take that credit. Thank you, Katrina. Thank you. Next question.
Hello. For the audible signals, do they need to have the noise at both ends of the crosswalk? So when you press from one side, does it require that it be transmitted from the beginning of your crossing the walk to the end on the other side for both Caltrans as well as for local areas?
That is correct. The installation of the APS for each corner of the intersection is required. So, and even if the intersection geometric is large and there is a median in the middle, it is recommended. It is not a standard. It should. The language in the California MUTCD, a placement of a accessible pedestrian signal system should be installed, especially if they are trying to put the timing for the pedestrian to move from one end to the other. For example, in Sacramento, there is a Capitol Street, and there are a very large median in the middle. So the timing is taking is carrying the pedestrian to move from one corner to the median, and then they will have to make sure that they do have the walk symbol for the rest of the intersection, because of the movement of the vehicles is sometimes it gets in conflict with the movement. So some situation like this, there is always a placement of the pedestrian push button and the APS in the median, and it should be in every corner. So you should be able to, and this is why I'm asking the specification has been changed to make sure that the contractor, once they do complete the installation of each corner, they want to make sure that each corner is compliant with the sound requirement to be able to be used. Thank you. Next question.
Yes, my name. Oh, sorry. Woke everybody up. This is Margaret Buckman-Garcia from Merced. I come from a town that has three state highways going through it, even though it is a fairly small town. And so we have different Caltrans infused into the city. I have two questions. One is, I have not heard any of the percussion signals nor the verbal signals, only the chirps and the cuckoos. Are those still supposed to be used?
No.
The percussion signal is not the peep-peep cuckoo. That's an older installation. This is what we used to have in the past. The California MUTCD requirement is it's a tick sound, and within the frequency, different variants of frequency of 880 hertz. So it should be different tick sound speed, but it's not the peep-peep-cook-cook.
Because it seems those are still being installed. My second question is, because we have the different Caltrans highways going through town, I've had pretty good success requesting an APS signal where it's clearly a local responsibility. They're pretty quick at responding to that. But when it involves one of the roads that is a state highway, it seems to become a battle between is it local or Caltrans, and it kind of goes back and forth and back and forth. Who determines that, and how is that determined?
What I would recommend, I do not know the situation about the particular district. What I do recommend is for you to contact the district ADA coordinator or the, like Katrina said, the headquarters ADA office, and we will try to go from there. You understand that the funding is very much limited, and we've been trying. Actually, it is not only for even the APS or application for pedestrian with mobility impairment. Is any application that has electrical system involved, we have to fight for the and justify for the funding, and this is why there are warranties for safety for even installation of traffic signals, because even though it may be very helpful, but even installation of traffic signal has to needs to meet at least two or three warrants. So even in any application, we kind of like, they have a lot of projects under the State Highway Operation Planning, and typically all the projects, the problem is the majority of the project, if not all, they are programmed for, and they must be included in a 10-year program, or sometimes it's a 5-year program. So the money is already called in for. They are earmarked for this. So that's why it is kind of, we're trying to do above and beyond and see what we can do to try to include, upgrade as much as we can, and coordinate with all the other program. So my recommendation is work with the ADA program, and we will go from there. Thank you. Next. I'm sorry, Jean.
You know, go on to the next person. We can only take about two more because we've got two other speakers.
Okay, go ahead.
Yes, this is Charlene. The signals that are to warn a motorist that a pedestrian wants to cross, if you are blind, is there any effort to make those audible in any way, shape, or form? Because as a person not seeing, I can't tell if I've got the light going to warn the motorist or not. I don't know when to enter the street.
Thank you. Again, the it seemed that the way I see it now, I'm all favor for the audible cross. To cross Broadway at Main Street, it's much easier for me to follow. But when I was working in updating the specs, I said, well, they told me, hey, it's not what in the California MUTCD. So this is what's available today in the California MUTCD, the requirement of the 10 feet spacing between the two poles. But again, if you need specifically the message, Typically, it comes in. Remember, I talked to you about the engineering judgment, the engineering study. The engineering study also include recommendation to the design engineer. So, if there is any engineering study, they should provide the recommendation to the designer to change the instruction to the contractor and say, "I want the audible message," because it is going to be up to the designer to tell the contractor how to program it. Is it by the tick message or by the audible message? So the designer can overrule the California MUTCD and tell the contractor, "I want the message to be programmed." Now, even if there is no engineering study, if you call in to the districts and coordinate with the ADA, then they will share the information to the designer, and the choice of message will be the audible message and not the percussive tone. Thank you.
Who would like to have the last question? Okay. Thank you. And I want to thank our two speakers for their excellent presentation. Let's give them a big hand. Even the pup agrees. So thank you very much for coming.
Thank you so much, Jean. I will wait outside, and I will,
if anyone wants to step out and ask either one of you questions, yes. Please. Okay. Thank you for coming, Katrina. Okay. We have a few minutes, and we're going to have Pam Metz and Charlene Ornelas, who are going to tell us their experience of getting a APS installed locally. And I asked, we'll have to, because we're going to run out of time, so they'll be concise, and when you have questions for them, please also try to be concise, and so we can try to get to everything. So I'm going to move the mic over to Charlene, and Charlene will tell us what's been her experience here in San Diego as to what has worked when putting requests for. Okay, let's switch it. Pam Metz. I'm moving the mic. Oh, shit. Okay.
Okay. There you go. Okay. Oh, Lord. Good morning, everybody. I have a cold, and so I'm going to keep this short. But one of the things, where we live in Chatsworth, they were building a bridge over tracks for the Orange Line, and anybody who lives in LA County knows about the Orange Line. But we live across the street from the Chatsworth train station. So when they finished, they had all this tactile information down there, strips on the sidewalk, rails to walk through, on each side of the track, all kinds of information. But they did not have an audible signal. And I didn't understand that. And I was out there working with a trainer, and he told me, he said, "Pam, you're just going to have to count 30 seconds and run across the street." Well, I said, "That's crazy. I'm not going to do that." So I thought about it for a while, and I called Mitch Pomerantz, because he used to work for LA City. And I asked him, who could I contact on getting an audible signal placed in front of our mobile home park so that I could cross the street into the train station or the bus station? And he gave me a name, an address, a name to contact. I contacted, her name was Angela. I contacted her. She put me in contact with another gentleman. And the most interesting thing is, I believe very strongly in advocacy. If you want something done, you have to do it. He came out and told me, well, it really doesn't need an audible signal. I said, then you put a blindfold on and go out there and cross the street. Lassen is not a very busy street, but with the trains there and people flying across the train tracks and the driveways are flush to the sidewalks, you could get killed. So we discussed it, and he went out there and checked again, and he said, well, Mrs. Metz, there is an audible signal out here. We just didn't turn it up because we didn't want to disturb the neighbors. And, okay, I had to keep my temper in check. Because the one thing my husband told me and Winifred Downing told me, if you want to succeed in advocacy, then you have to keep calm. So I said, why would you not? I said, the only places around here that need quiet is the mobile home park. And because it's next to a train track, we got this 3-foot cement block wall around it. They couldn't hear anything if they wanted to, so why didn't the city turn it up? We didn't think about it. What's the reason? Well, now it's you can hear the beep beep for the location, and when you press the button, it makes either a faster beep or a slower beep, and the faster beep just lets me know it's time to cross the street. And it comes in handy with the guide dog because the street and sidewalk are flush to each other. So the dog thinks it's another sidewalk. So Ken and I have ended up many times across the street and not meaning to. But what I want to say is, if you there's a street that a friend of ours crosses a lot, Balboa, in the valley, and it's a horrendously hard street to cross. I actually crossed it with my dog, and it is not easy to cross. And I am going to be working and trying to get the city of Northridge to get audible signals on those corner APSs on that corner, because that is a hard corner to cross. And you could get killed very easily if you're not listening to the flow of traffic. But sorry, I have a bad cold. Advocacy is important. So if you want something done, find out the way to do it and go about getting it done. Otherwise, you're just going to sit there at home and not travel because you can't get around outside. And I like to travel and get around outside. So it's important. It was important for me to get this signal up. But for them not to turn it on was crazy because it's the mobile home park. And next to the mobile home park is an auto shop. They don't need it quiet. And that's it. It's an industrial area. It's not really apartments on the block. So that was their reason for not having an audible or not having it up. Well, it's up now, and it works great. And I really appreciate Mitch's help and the city's help with this. Thank you.
Mike. Okay. We're going to have Charlene Arnalos give her explanation or what she's.
Oh, I have one. Okay. This is even better. I'm not going to tell you a specific location. What I'm going to do is tell you how you can apply to your location. First of all Title II entities under ADA have to have a person in charge of ADA. If it's less than 50 employees, it can be an individual that has that task added to their regular schedule or their regular duties. If there's more than 50 employees, they have to have a person designated as an ADA coordinator. It's a permanent it's a position, not just somebody's extra job. If it's also they need to have, the cities need to have an ADA advisory committee or input. That means they need to have people from all disabilities. In San Diego, we have there is a committee, and it's done through, it is under the mayor, used to be under the city of, No, it used to be under the city manager, but it got changed to being under the mayor. But still,
If you're interested in it or you want to, there is a ADA coordinator and an actual ADA department with engineers that make sure that things are compliant and they work with traffic engineering. So check and see if that exists in your city. I also working with small towns or smaller, like Oceanside. They have a person that is assigned to the tasks. One of the things they did when I asked for an audible signal is they told me I needed to send them proof of my disability. That is an absolute under any circumstance against the law. You may never have to prove that you are disabled or indicate what the disability is. If you're in need of something, that's it. So keep that in mind, that you don't have to give them a doctor's note saying that you are blind and you need an audible signal. All you have to do is say, this is an intersection and I need an audible signal. So some cities, it's going to be your public works department. They're going to be in charge of signals. Others will have a separate traffic division. If there's a person that if your city is like San Diego and has a separate ADA coordinator, my advice is when you contact traffic engineering regarding an audible signal, whether it be a repair or a new installation, follow up by letting your ADA department know also. Thank you.
Okay, we're on. And the one thing, too, is that sometimes you have to resort to is when you get nowhere is looking into structured negotiations. And that's how we got CCB, got San Francisco to install citywide APSs. Unfortunately, not automatically when they put in new signals do they do it, but a good percentage of them they are. So that is something as last resort where you have to take legal action. Look at structure negotiations. So, are there questions for the two presenters? Yes, Ken. If it gets you on the mic.
Thank you. Let me also say that in some of the smaller cities, one of the things you can do a lot of times if the traffic engineers don't adhere to your needs or tell you that they can't, you can also call City Hall, find out when their meetings are, and ask to have the item agendized at one of their meetings. And that way you can actually speak up at one of the city meetings that they're having. It works pretty well if you're in a smaller city. Those are things that they're really looking for because that's where you can still have some of that old hometown type of atmosphere where you can still attend, you can speak out and really tell them exactly what the needs are. The only thing I can say is before you speak about it, make sure you know the facts in case they're going to ask you questions regarding the ADA. Make sure you study it. Make sure you contact someone even within CCB if you're not sure about what your rights are. But you do have a lot of rights that some of the cities don't know about. Thank you.
Yes, the lady in the back.
Hi, this is Donna Pomerantz. In Pasadena, the City of Roses, some of you visit us during the Rose Parade. One of the things that CCB was very successful at is getting audible pedestrian signals through some of us serving on their city commission. So some of us became city commissioners, and others who didn't want to serve on the commission were out in the community getting ready to, and available to speak to specific intersections and things. So you can kind of come at it from a number of different ways as well. So definitely, if your city folks get to know you, you know, coming in, helping do the work of, you know, of the city, whether as a commissioner, whether,
oh, that's okay,
whether as a, you know, a community member coming to meetings and things like that, that's always a real successful way to do. So kind of get somebody on the inside from CCB and then somebody out in the community who can help speak and support the people on the inside. So that's how we were able to do it in Pasadena as well. And we have somewhere our chapter meets as well in Glendora, and that's been a very good thing. So when you find one that you don't hear, that you didn't know was in a certain intersection, write to your city hall or even call or send an email and say, I'm a person who's blind. I was visiting your city, or I live here, and there was an audible pedestrian signal at the intersection of such and such. And it really helped me. And, you know, you don't have to be all formal. Just tell them thank you for that. And that really goes a long way, too. Thank you.
Another person who wants to ask a question or comment? No?
I got one. I just wanted to add, piggyback upon what comments are meant for small town, especially in the heyday of all the building that was going on in our community. One of our members went to the Planning Commission when they were proposing a new development that was going to include traffic signals, and he proposed that they include audible pedestrian signals in on the traffic signals that were going to be put up, and to make it part of the developer's costs rather than the city having to do that after the fact. And that got approved at that meeting and got later became a city ordinance. So I like the comments that people have been making to get involved in some of those city decision-making groups, because now we have audible signals whenever new developments are created in our area. One of the areas where there was a signal out in the middle of nowhere, and every once in a while you'd hear the chirps and tweets, still our area, but because maybe a bike ride or something went through the area, and now a new high school has been built almost next door to it, so it's a very welcome addition that somebody thought of 5-6 years ago.
Okay, one last comment or question. No? Okay. I guess if there's not, is there somebody there?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Let me just say, too, is keep in mind with the presentation we just had earlier. Caltrans has the policy, and they're not having to have people jump through hoops for the warrants, and that's what the locals are going to hit you with, that they have to be certain criteria, because all accessible pedestrian signals are not mandated by federal law at all, as much as we would like them. We can argue in the program access, but they're not required at this time until the public right-of-way guidelines ever get adopted, and they've been worked on for now close to 20 years. But so you're going to have that. So when you go, like all the suggestions, totally agree with, is like network with other professionals, like get an orientation mobility specialist who is really in support of the signals to go with you to these when you go before the city council or you go to the county clerk or us to investigate. You know, and they're not going to, you don't want them to speak for you, but they, as a professional, will be given that professional respect from the engineers. Unfortunately, you got to accept that. That will happen. And that, so they say, yes, there's a real need for this. That will help cut through some of this warrants that you have to go through to show this justification. You know, sometimes the warrants they look at is how many accidents have occurred where a pedestrian's been hit there. Sometimes they look at how many, the neighborhood and all those things, and it's like you can argue, the fact is, look, it's just giving us an information that's visually available to a pedestrian now.
all I'm asking for is an alternative and audible. But unfortunately, traffic engineers do not always understand that it's equipment. They think it is like getting a brand new signal installed, which is a mistake. And we've dealt with that, unfortunately, and it's a challenge. But all the suggestions have been excellent. Please do that. And I'll let Charlene make the last recommendation. Go ahead.
If you don't know who to contact in your city, contact the city clerk, and that person should be able to look it up and research it and tell you if there's a committee or who to contact. Thank you.
Okay. So let's give our Pam Metz and Charlene Ornelas a big hand. Thank you very much, and the meeting is adjourned.